If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, May the 2nd. Welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. Our guest today in Hoover's media studio here in the Stanford University campus is John Cochran. He is the Jack and Rosemary Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, and an adjunct scholar of the Cato Institute. John Cochran frequently contributes editorial opinion essays to the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg.com, and other publications. Last and certainly not least, he is the proprietor and author of the Grumpy Economist blog. I love that title, The Grumpy Economist. Today, John, I want to talk about something you wrote for Hoover's Defining Ideas web channel. The title of it was Stock Market Gyrations. And I'm going to read you the lead from your column, and I'll warn you, this is like a radio DJ playing Iron Butterfly's Inagata Davida. You can talk for 20 minutes after I read this to you, but I want to understand why you wrote this. Here's what you wrote. Quote, in February 2018, the stock market suddenly returned to greater volatility. The emergence of volatility seems alarming and raises some questions. Is today's situation like 1929, a harbinger of economic catastrophe, or is it like 2007? Is it like 1999? Is it like 1974, the annus horribilis, in which the stock market drifted down 40%, along with economic stagflation and did not recover until the 1980s? Is it like 1987, a quick dip followed by recovery in a year? Or is it just an extended version of the flash crash of 2010 when the market went down 10% in a few hours and bounced back by the end of the day? Are we in a bubble that's about to burst? How much of this has to do with the Fed? And you say, John?
Let's answer all those questions in one. I should also advertise there's a longer version of the gyrations on my blog, The Grumpy Economist, and more to follow because this is an issue that I'm actively thinking about. What's going on with markets and where are we in the business cycle? What is, is it going to be sunshine forever or what monsters lie over the horizon?
Right.
Let's start our conversation with the volatility. So, yeah, last February, all of a sudden, stocks became more volatile. The market started going up and down more every day. In the end, it turned out not to be the beginning of a big crash. It's just instead of going up and down a small amount every day, it went up and down a bigger amount every day.
Right. This was specifically, John, this is the stretch from February the 5th to February the 9th when the Dow in four of those 5 days went anywhere from 1,021 points up and down in a single day to 1,596 points up and down in a single day.
Yes. And now it's settled back down. Last time I looked, so a good number for volatility is to think of the annual volatility. So it's the typical amount of stocks go up and down in a year. Mm-hmm. The typical number is about 20%, which
right.
is actually a lot. In a typical year, stocks will go up or down 20%. I wish I knew which way, but one or the other. Mm-hmm. The puzzle is that volatility had been so low. For a long stretch, it had been down to 10%, half of normal. And it, after those couple days in February, it kind of returned to the normal of 20%. So what does that mean? There's two kinds of volatility. I think the technical volatility, like the flash crash, like 1987, something happens in
right.
the machinery of the system that goes a little bit wrong, and you get a period of what's up, boom, 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 and then it all settles down again. I've been reading about it. I have not heard a credible argument that our episode was technical, mm-hmm. and the volatility has remained. We're now it's not unusual. We're just back to normal. Let's remember, it's just back. The puzzle of anything is why, through the end of the Obama era, through Trump being elected, through God knows what cacophony in our country, stocks had just been trundling along at 10% volatility, but they had, and now we're back to normal. So I think, at least in our search for answers, we have to go back not to technical things in the markets, but instead to what does this mean about the macroeconomy and where are we in the business cycle, where are stocks in their cycle, and that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, I did a little math for you, John. The Dow on inaugural day Donald Trump comes into office, closes at 19,827. It had a bit of a volatile day that day, actually. It actually fell 70 points while Trump was giving his speech, and then it recovered and finished up 95 points on the day. Today is May the 2nd, 2018, John. The Dow closed at 23,925. If you do the math on that, that is a gain over the period of his presidency of 20.6%. So it gets back to your 20% gain you had said. But politicians obviously love to embrace the Dow as a sign of a healthy economy. But you as an economist, where does that figure into your puzzle?
Yeah, they embrace it when it goes up, and when it goes down, the markets are irrational. Yes, it was interesting that the markets first thought this was a disaster and then realized maybe not.
Right.
However, when you look at the broad sweep of things, markets go up during economic expansions and they go down during recessions. Now, the unfortunate fact of a podcast is I can't show you the graph, but let me advertise in either of the on the blog or in Defining Ideas, there's a lovely graph which will just make this case brilliantly for you. Stock markets go up in expansions and down in recessions. And this expansion has not been unusual. The stock market has gone up a lot, but the expansion, as you mentioned, is like 8 years long, and it's been trundling up at exactly the same rate it trundles up in normal expansions. So much as we'd love to give credit or blame to our favorite political figures, which is both Obama and Trump, take your pick, the market has been trundling up about the same under each. In its normal pattern for a normal slow expansion, which is where we are, and it's high just simply because it's been going. Now, it was high and quiet. Now it's high back to volatility. And I think that ties in well with where we are economically. It's been 8 years. Unemployment started up at around 10. Now it's back down to about 4. I forget, I don't have the exact numbers with me, but we're
about
back.
3.9, I think.
3.9, yeah. So the part of the expansion that is recovery from a recession, that is lack of demand, that is getting back to normal, that part of the expansion is over.
Right.
And I think we're all looking around and saying, well, what now? And I think what if I'm going to give a story to the markets and the volatility is markets woke up and said, oh, wow, that's over. What's going to happen now? Does the expansion end of its own? Is there a source of a new recession? Let's look over and see what's going. And there's some uncertainty associated with that.
So what happened in February, John, was not the first time in the history of the Dow Jones that it's yo-yoed in a single day. If you go back to 2015, there was a swing over 1,000 points on one day. That was driven by bad economic news coming out of China. The market had a conniption. We mentioned the flash crash, which I believe was caused by a large sell order in E-mini trades, which triggered that event. Also a $1,000 swing in a day. That was in 2010. 6 weeks, John, from late September 2008 to November 2008. There are 8 days in which the market yo-yos anywhere from 700 to 1,000 points, but that's readily definable as the Great Recession, the financial crisis. What's curious to me about what happened in February is trying to diagnose that disease. Is it really a disease or just kind of a glitch? Or is this really kind of the new of the Trump economy, where you're going to see days where the market has dizzying highs and dizzy lows?
The volatility we're having, again, it's back to normal. There is a lot of political uncertainty, and so that, in fact, it's been a little bit surprising that it was so quiet for so long, given the uncertainty about what's going to happen. But I think so this one I do not think was technical, like as we mentioned, like the flash crash. When you look back 10 years or so and make a plot of volatility, again, the plots that we can talk about, but this is like an art podcast. We have to talk about paintings we can't see.
Yes.
But make a plot of volatility over a longer time period. And what you'll see is that events like what we just happened, a sharp rise in volatility, do sometimes come just before bad stuff. Volatility comes when there's a dispersion of opinion, when people, lots of new information is hitting the market. Volatility is about the speed with which information hits the market. Low volatility and just steady rise means, well, kind of normal times, but there's no news. It can be good news, it can be bad news, but there's no news. Volatility is when lots of news or opinion is hitting the market. Now, so there are periods of volatility just before the cliff, just before the catastrophe. There was volatility just before the world fell apart in 2008. But if you look at history, the old joke about forecasters about the stock market remains true. Volatility has forecast 9 out of the last 5 cliffs. So you'll see there every year or two, there's a spike when all of a sudden the market gets very volatile. People worry about, is something happening, the taper tantrum, and then it kind of falls away. So that's equally likely this time too, that this is just a brief It's sort of like what happens if you had too much tequila and you go to try to sleep at night. You wake up every 2 hours with some bad dream, and then you go back to sleep again.
Right. So if you're a long-term investor, John, not a day trader, somebody who's playing in stocks every few weeks or so, buying and selling, but somebody who's in it for the long haul, somebody who's putting their money into IRAs and looking at their retirements down the road, at what point do you become concerned about volatility? Do you freak out the week that is happening, or do you calm down after it's over? Or, at what point do you really get concerned about this?
Always. Because volatility is, of the market as a whole, is your basic measure of the risk in the market. So,
The cliche is you're in the market for the long haul.
Yes. Unfortunately, the market remains a random walk in the long haul. Now, what I mean by that is in some cases, like the flash crash, the market went down and then bounced back up again. And if you could have gotten in, that was a buying opportunity of all time. But almost all the time, these daily big moves are not reliably followed by a move the other way. If you lose 5% in a day, it's gone forever. Right. If you gain 5% in a day, it's there forever. There's small amounts by which markets diverge from that, but not much at all. So it is when volatility gets higher, the amount of your money that is at risk gets higher. It's a mistake to think of it as volatility is a signal get out because the market's about to go down. Volatility doesn't predict that the market's going to go up or the market's going to go down. There's some small effects there that if you're a hedge fund manager, we can talk about. But the average investor needs to think of volatility just as the risk. And if you're not prepared for an annual possible for a 20% loss, then you shouldn't be in the market. The kind of risk that a really long-run investor can afford to sit out is the much lower, if there's a recession and stocks go down, they will come back up again. So there is a definite tendency, like happened in 2008. 2008, stocks crashed. If you had bought in March 2009, you would have get the bounce back. There was a definite bounce back, and we kind of knew that would happen. Those you can think about trying to look at and certainly not worry too much about. Daily volatility, though, it is risk, and the stock market is now 20% riskier, and think about that when you make your investments.
Donald Trump on Saturday night eschews the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and instead he holds a rally in Michigan. It's basically a campaign rally, just what he did out of the book in 2016. And he says the following passage, John. I want you to interpret what President Trump was saying here. He said, quote, "The stock market, which is not really the all-time indicator because the country is actually doing much better than the stock market," adding, quote, "it would have been up 60%, but I have to do things. I can't let other countries take advantage of us, so we're doing trade deals." What is Donald Trump talking about?
You're asking me seriously to channel Donald Trump?
Well, you're not going to tell me how the market's going to go. I'm going to make life just as hard to make you channel.
Yeah, I guess that's
true. But he is making a reference to his tariff policy.
So, I wish he was the kind of guy that we could follow up quotes with, because if what you just said is true, then he's saying that his trade threats have cost us 60% market. He said the market would be up 60% more.
Right.
So that is an enormous cost to ask all Americans to bear in order to save two or three steel jobs and lose hundreds more on people who use steel.
Yes. I'm leading into is what you posted today on Grumpy Economist, which is you asked a very simple question. What's worse than tariffs? And you had a one-word answer, which is?
Quotas.
Why?
Tariffs, which we ought to call import taxes, that's what they are. What they do is they try to keep out foreign, say, steel by making them pay a 25% tax at the borders they come in. Mm-hmm. So that means our steel prices go up 25%, and the federal government makes some money. We could lower imports the same amount with a quota, simply tell the foreigners they may only sell so much steel to us. Let's put the quota so the price also goes up 25%. But now that 25% price rise goes straight into the pockets of the foreign producer,
right,
not into the U.S. Treasury, which, in case you haven't looked, could use the money, first of all. Secondly, it's now hidden. If everybody sees the tariff, we all know we're paying 25% too much for our steel. If it's a quota, this country's had sugar quotas since the 1790s. Mm-hmm. If it's a quota, the price can be 4, 5, 6 times higher than it is in the rest of the world, and it's awfully hard for anybody to know what's actually going on, which is why protected industries love quotas and they don't like tariffs. The quota, furthermore, think how this works. So in Korea, where there's a big announcement that South Korea has now agreed with the U.S. We're exempt from the tariff because they agreed on a quota.
Right.
So what happens? Korea may only sell to us, I don't know, 100 million tons of steel. That means the Korean government sits down with the Korean companies and divvies up who gets to sell how much steel to the U.S. and who gets this fat 25% extra profit,
right,
or more. So it's, I mean, we like to think of antitrust and our governments trying to break up monopolies. We're giving a present to foreign companies and encouraging foreign governments to form government monopolies among them to divvy it up, which, of course, you know, you can think of the corruption that that leads to. And this was the announcement, the larger announcement was that, oh, yes, we're going to back off the tariffs because we're going to start negotiating quotas around the world with everyone, leading to a system of sort of government-managed trade and everything, at the same time that we're trying to break up the AT&T merger because we don't like monopolies. It's just, so have I frothed enough at the mouth about this whole thing to get you going?
No, but you raise a very good point. Where do you think this White House is going with the discussion of tariffs? It's now they pump the brakes on this. Do you think they're actually going to go through on these threats, or do you think they're going to mildly back off?
I think personally,
John, I see him whipsawed on this. On the one hand, he has to make good on campaign promises, especially in certain states that got him elected. On the other hand, he's looking at the stock market. He's looking at economic growth. And somebody at least is whispering in his ear, don't mess with a good thing.
Yes. I think, you know, tariffs are an economic fallacy from the 1750s. Adam Smith kind of put them to rest. But it's a very powerful fallacy, and it's very natural for business people going into government to make the standard mistake that's what's good for my business is good for the country. Mm-hmm. What's good for Hoover's business is if we could stop all those foreign imports of think tanks. What's good for any country, for an individual business. But of course, what you're doing is you're screwing the consumer and stop. Any individual business likes low competition, but the country likes lots of competition. And there's quite a conundrum if you make a fuss about that, and then you go into office and discover that that's not how the world works, that in fact open trade is good for the country as a whole, that steel workers and their businesses, mostly their businesses may gain, but the country as a whole loses, and you learn that fact. You also learn that the system of international institutions that the U.S. put together in 1945 wasn't such a bad idea after all. It's very helpful for a small country trying to stand up to its steel producers to say, I'd love to help you, but we signed the WTO. Yeah, we can't right. do this, as opposed to, I'd love to help you, and I'm going to go negotiate that with President Trump tomorrow. So, and he signed up with this guy, Peter Navarro, who is straight from that scholastic school of mercantilism. And yeah, you float these ideas and then you figure out they're bad ideas and you got to back off. Now, the great thing about Trump is I cannot imagine that he feels particularly the need to hold to anything he said. I know he finds it very important to connect with his base,
right.
And as a president should connect with his supporters, but doesn't necessarily, as he's backed off the wall the same way. And there's a good sense in which I think the way out of this is you do symbolic things and you declare victory and you deliver strong economic performance.
Exactly.
If we stay out of a recession, if this turns into another 3 or 4 years of strong supply side growth, if America's problem is not unemployment at the end of Trump's first term, but that companies can't find workers to fill their jobs. if everybody's doing great, nobody will care what he promised about China 6 years ago.
We're pretty close to full employment right now, aren't we?
We're doing darn well. The labor force participation is still a problem. So unemployment is the number of people looking for a job. That's
right.
Low. There are a shocking number of people who aren't even looking for a job.
Right.
But it's not clear that that's a demand problem as opposed to a skills problem, a stuck in a social program that taxes away your earnings problem,
right.
A stuck in the wrong part of the country problem, a educational system problem, as opposed to a demand problem.
Exactly. So thank you for mentioning the recession and continued growth. You're teeing up my next question. The Great Recession, John, ended in about June of 2009. I believe that's the end mark for it. We're now in May of 2018, so this marks month 107 of consecutive economic growth. 107, that's significant. Why? That matches what happened in the 1960s during the Kennedy and Johnson years. Now, if we can get to July of 2019, a year plus from now, continued growth, that'll match the 10-year stretch from 1991 to 2001. Here's what I'd like you to explain to me, John. The 1960s growth was driven in large part by the Great Society, was it not? A large amount of government spending?
No, but go ahead.
No, okay. Shoot that one down.
I don't believe in multipliers. Okay.
Well,
but
you can explain that in a minute. The 91 to 2001 boom coincides with the birth of the information age. So
yes.
We tie those two together. So go back and correct my bad history on the 1960s. But more to the point, John, explain what is driving 107 months of economic recovery.
Recovery. economies heal the same way that wounds heal. In some sense, all on their own. We have this, everybody has this desire for agency. We want to see some great force moving things around. Mm-hmm. The same way medieval people wanted doctors to come in and they bled you and gave you leeches and then the wound healed and you said, the doctor saved me. Well, the same is true of our economy has been on the natural process of recovery for 8 years now. In some ways, the government didn't make matters a lot worse, except the Obama-era regulations and the social programs, I think, actually got in the way a good deal. If you pay people not to work, they don't work. And especially if you take away their earnings, if they do work, they don't work. But that healing process is over. Mm-hmm. Now we move into, but then the easy growth is over. So there's sort of an easy growth of healing, of letting people who are out of work and looking for work, getting them matched up with jobs and getting the economy going again. Mm-hmm. We're done with that. Now, if you want to grow output, you can't just take unemployed people and put them with unemployed machines and get them, get the sand out of the gears and go. You need new gears. We need to get GDP to grow now. You need either new people, immigrants, young people, or get people who are not even trying to work right now. You need new physical investment, new machines, or you, best of all, you need productivity. You need the people and machines to make more per hour of what they work. That's where supply side growth comes from.
Right.
I'm enthusiastic about the deregulation effort, especially. I wish the first effort on taxes would be followed by a second one. But the kind of things you need to keep this going now are first not to screw it up with something like a trade war or a financial problem, and second to move to that kind of supply side growth. As what happened in the 90s is a good example. We invented the internet. Well, or Al Gore invented the internet, or someone invented the internet. The Department of Defense invented the internet, and
yes.
Silicon Valley figured out how to make it useful.
Right.
And that was a big boom. And also the biggest part of that boom was not inventing the internet, but computerization of businesses. Airlines have websites, not people you call. Good luck trying to call it. And that's a tremendous boon to productivity. We're set for that kind of boon. Just hang around the valley here. There's all sorts of great ideas waiting to make their way into productivity. So, the good side of the story was we move out of government-directed, spending-directed, stimulus, just putting people back to work, and we move into a supply-side boom of that sort. That's the hope.
This is an administration, John, that talks constantly about 3% GDP growth. I think the real GDP growth in 2017 was something closer to about 2.3%. I'm an economic layman. These are abstract numbers to me. Explain to me the difference between 3% and 2.3%.
Huge.
But what does it really tangibly translate to?
What it translates to is, now we're talking, what matters here is long-term growth rates. Mm-hmm. So a year or two of stimulus, it's like what matters to your health is not an espresso this morning, but get the diet and exercise down and so that your long-run health is better. If you grow over 10 to 20 years at 3% rather than 2.3%, it sounds like a little number, mm-hmm. but just compound 3 versus 2.3. And I can't do it in my head, But it's the kind of thing that over 20, 30 years between you and your children means that you can double their standard of living or not. So those kinds of differences. And they matter not just to our standard of living. Let me make this say, it's not about do you have two cars or three cars. It's about how many people have cars. Right. It's about health care. I mean, what are we going to spend it on at this point? You know, how many people can afford or can we pay for genomic testing? It's about, does the government go bankrupt or not? Because the only way the government is going to make enough money to pay off its debts is if we grow really fast. There's not enough, you can't raise taxes enough to pay this stuff.
Is there something magical about 3%, or is 3 just a nice sexy political number to throw?
I think it's a sexy political number. My own guess is that 4% is achievable. Now you have to get to the kind of policies no one's talking about to do that.
Right.
The way to see what I think the enormous potential of our economy is you look across countries. We tend to forget China is still enormously poor relative to the U.S. We're $54,000 per capita of GDP. They're about $8,000. Forgive me if I get the numbers. That's order of magnitude. And India's poorer than that, about $2,000 to $3,000. There's these enormous differences. Why are countries so different in their levels? Well, the U.S. is still a much better place to do business. If you line up the ease of doing business index with income per capita, it lines up very nicely. And the U.S. isn't nirvana for ease of doing business. So I think if you unleash the supply side of the economy, there's the potential to get a level of GDP that's twice what we have now. Mm-hmm. And you grow a lot on your way to get there.
Right.
It's just one simple example. Houses in California cost about 5 times as much as they should be. That means if we just got rid of residential, now there's reasons for them, but the zoning restrictions and stuff are causing houses to be 5 times as much as they should be. That means if you're spending half your money on a house, that means your income could be 2.5 times what is now effectively. GDP in California, measured by what you get, could be 2.5 times as big as it is now if we just got rid of the impediments to building houses. That's a kind of a humorous back of the envelope, but think of all of the things, healthcare, that could be cheaper and more efficient, more innovative, if we got out of the way. You know, think of how long it took. Well, Uber's a great example because it worked. Uber fought the regulatory barriers, and now we go places at half price. And that's just the regulations keeping the old taxi monopolies in place. We get half price, better service, better employment for people. Our economy is full of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's fascinating to watch the debt struggle going on with Uber, Lyft, and taxi unions in San Francisco and other cities over who's going to survive this.
Right. Now, in most industries, if you want to start a new healthcare industry, your healthcare business that's competitive, that's the Uber of healthcare, good luck.
Exactly.
The FDA, the Obamacare, you're not going to get started because the taxi unions are, the equivalent of taxi unions are fully in control. So I think there's potential in the U.S. economy to grow at astronomical rates. Can we get to 3%? That's just a question of how much of clean up the regulations, which isn't deregulate, it's get them effective and get them working. Clean up the mess of an insane tax code that we have. This isn't tax cuts. This is about simplification of the system so that it's not standing in the way. And those are just two of the biggest things we could do. And let new businesses come in and make life really awful for existing businesses.
Right. There are half-empty voices out there, voices of pessimism, John, one of them being Larry Summers, the former Clinton Treasury Secretary, former president of Harvard. In 2013, he laid out a scenario involving what he called, quote, secular stagnation. It's an economic term I'd like to explain to me. He was interviewed the other day, John, and he said, quote, sooner or later, we're going to hit the wall. Now, that sounds a bit like me just watching LeBron James take free throws and saying, well, he's going to miss sooner or later, but does Mr. Summers have a point? Sooner or later, we're going to hit a wall. And what about secular stagnation? What exactly is that?
Okay, so like all economic buzzwords, we need to ask people to define what the hell they're talking about if
yes.
we want to get some sense of it. There's two kind of stagnation hypotheses that are floating around. One is perpetual lack of demand. I think that's what Summers has in mind. Mm-hmm. The other is Bob Gordon's idea that we've run out of ideas. They promised us jet cars, and all we got was 140 characters, and that sort of we reached the technological limits of growth. Summers' idea of sectoral stagnation was perpetual lack of demand. I think that's just fallen. First, Summers isn't even something happened. I'm not quite sure in November 2016, but since then, Summers has been talking about the sugar high economy, mm-hmm. as opposed to perpetual lack of demand. And he's mad about tax cuts because he thinks those are overstimulating the economy. So all of a sudden, lack of demand doesn't seem to be the problem. Right. And when you look at the unemployment rate, actually came down. It was very high, but it came down faster in this recession than it did before. So perpetually high unemployment, lack of demand, just doesn't ring to be the problem. Now we have slow growth, but it's just amazing how the small tax cut and deregulation efforts right. have led to finally companies getting off their butts and investing, and the economy growing. And what they've actually accomplished so far is quite small on the supply side. And look at the effect it's had. So I think that the story that there's perpetual lack of demand just doesn't hold up. And I don't really hear. Summers seems to have forgotten it, too.
So differentiate, John, the difference between actually being legitimately concerned about the economy versus just sounding like somebody who wants to sub for Paul Krugman when he's on vacation.
Well,
I mean, on one hand, you can be legitimately naysaying. On the other hand, there is such a thing as getting involved in the political cycle.
Yeah. And so the thing that most annoys me about Krugman is that he writes in the pages of the New York Times about what people's motivations are, which he cannot possibly know.
Right.
So I will not speculate on anybody's motivations. Certainly, the tax cut led to some apoplexy. Summers wrote a number of op-eds and lots of, they self-identify as Democratic economists or are writing op-eds about the tax cuts. Mm-hmm. I too would have liked a revenue neutral reform of the tax code. We got a lower marginal rate and we got an overall cut. The lower marginal rate is the useful thing. Mm-hmm. Would have been nicer if it was revenue neutral, but, you know, economists should pay more attention to incentives and less to distribution. I mildly think the tax code was a good thing because it made the incentives to invest better. And look, lo and behold, we're having a lot of investment. Overall, it's a small thing. So I don't, it's 1% of GDP. Our deficits are 5% of GDP, and the looming Social Security stuff is on the order of 10% of GDP.
Right.
So, you know, to get all mad about that 1% of GDP deficit for a while seems to me to miss the elephants in the room.
Right. So let's talk about a couple more benchmarks. We've talked about unemployment. We've talked about GDP growth. What about wage growth? Slower than Trump would like, correct?
Well, so we all want non-inflationary wage growth.
Right.
The whole point is wage growth. In the end, where does wage growth come from? Productivity growth.
Mm-hmm.
It does not come from better negotiation. So, you know, you're and my great, 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 whatever, were out there hoeing potatoes in some fields or whatever great, great grandparents did, and they got paid a pittance for it. We are not that much wealthier because we negotiated better with the farmer who hired us. We're better because we're more productive.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, that's where wage growth comes from, and to pay attention to much of anything else is a mistake. So we need productivity growth. Where does productivity growth come from? Investment in better machines, better technology, and in better businesses. Productivity growth comes from that very unpleasant part of the new business comes in, and A&P was more productive than the mom-and-pop stores, and Walmart was more productive than A&P, and Amazon's more productive than Walmart, and everybody hates the whole process as it comes along, and that's what makes us better off.
Final stat, John, and that is debt to GDP, which is soon to be its highest, I think, in about 70 years.
Yeah, so debt is I think, the big cloud on the horizon. It's very unusual that we're running such enormous deficits at the sort of the late September of the business cycle, when normally we would be putting some stuff away for a rainy day. Even today's deficits are not that much of an issue. The problem is we have this entitlements coming.
Right.
If we were running, 5% of GDP deficits, but there was a plan for the future to pay them off, no worries. We had much higher debt than we've had higher debt than we have now at the end of World War II. Well, we ran it up for a reason, saving the world, And we were going to stop spending because we didn't need the big army anymore, so there's a plan to pay it back. Our problem right now is not so much the current deficits as we've made promises that we cannot keep simultaneously to beneficiaries, to bondholders, and to taxpayers. And we are going to default on one of those sets of promises. My hope is that we get out of it by reforming the social programs. If we do it now and just clean up the incentives, people who need the help will still get the help. We won't get to the situation that people are counting on programs that then we have to cut in a haphazard manner, mm-hmm. Or undergo some sort of debt crisis or massive tax expropriation. So there is a fairly easy answer, but it needs doing now.
Right. So you're busy this week. There's a conference going on here.
Yes, there is.
Tell us what you're up to.
We're having the annual Monetary Policy Conference. Which is a great Hoover event, and even your podcast listeners, it's all going to be available on the web. We don't live stream it, but all the materials, the talks, and the papers come out.
It'll be at hoover.org.
Hoover, thank you. Right. Hoover.org.
Hoover.org, and also I think CNBC is going to be doing some. Are you going to go on TV, John?
We will have lots of media present. Yes. Mm-hmm. What's good about this conference is it lies right in the middle. There are academic conferences, which would be great for putting you to sleep. Somebody stands up, and a slide full of equations with Greek letters goes up, and those of us in the business, ooh and ah, and everybody else says, oh my gosh. Then there are policy conferences where big shots and officials get up and go blah 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 blah, mm-hmm. and they say all sorts of things that equally put you to sleep because there's this jargon, and who knows what I don't know what half of the stuff means. This is a combination. This is where academics and practitioners meet. We have a bunch of Federal Reserve officials talking policy. We have a bunch of academics who are told, you better take your studies and explain how it works and how it matters for policy. We think about deeper issues. It's not just, will they bump up or down a quarter of a percentage point at the next meeting? Mm-hmm. We think about how should monetary policy evolve in the big picture. So it's been in the last couple of years we've been doing it. It's been a great and productive discussion, and I hope it is once again.
So what comes out of this conference? Do you write out of this conference? Do you go to D.C. and talk to leaders out of the conference? What does this contribute to?
Knowledge. In the great cloud of knowledge. I mean, there's a practical. We do a book and a website, and I think the people come and they learn something. And so practical written stuff gets done, mm-hmm. and then I think policymakers are challenged by academics who will say, no, wait a minute, what are you talking about? How does that work? And they go, we always said it worked. Okay, how does it work? And I think our academics are challenged by policymakers and understand what their concerns are and how they think the world works.
So in this day and age, John, as an economist, somebody who's very visible, you have an idea. You're sitting under, we're in Palo Alto, it's not an apple tree, it might be a lemon tree or an orange tree, but you're struck on the head by a piece of fruit, and voila, you've solved a great problem. How do you put it out there? Do you write a piece for the Wall Street Journal? Do you put it on your blog? Do you try to put together a meeting? Do you go to Washington and try to get congressmen's attention? How do you put an idea out there into the stratosphere?
Well, that depends what kind of idea it is. Just last night at 2 in the morning, I had an idea about identification properties in New Keynesian models. Obviously, that's not going to the Wall Street Journal.
Did you write it down?
it's there. I'm getting there.
Are you one of those people who goes to bed with a pad by his...
No, I can remember one idea until morning.
Good for you.
Ideas, there's the standard process of... write working papers, submit them to academic journals, give them at academic conferences is still there and functional for academic ideas developing in that conversation. When you have a policy idea, that's what blogs, Twitter, Wall Street Journal op-eds. What's great about Hoover is we kind of mix all of those things together and you have good ways of not just putting ideas out, but discussing and refining ideas. All ideas need to be batted back and forth a couple times before they hit the world.
And what's the role of economist, John, with a president who frankly needs a little nudging in a certain area?
I think economists would be better off if they stopped thinking of themselves as grand viziers who need to speak to the great person in power. First of all, economists are terrible at it. Most research economists are just not very good at understanding issues in simple terms and getting them ready for policy. Most research economists are tremendously excited about their latest research. And there's a great tendency to get on a plane, go to Washington. Here's my great idea. You just blah, 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 blah. Now spend $1 trillion tomorrow. Thank you. Where do I send for my reimbursement? And that's just not very productive. And I have to, realize, when you look at what most of our profession has done giving policy advice, it has not turned out that great. Let's witness the grand struggle of trying to get your health care and health insurance to work. I think we do best in the world of ideas, but the world that you and I are now talking to. If the average person evaluating a candidate, thinking about policy, having a coffee with his friends, says, yeah, we got to stop those Chinese steel imports from coming in that are ruining the country, well, that's what's going to happen. If the average person understands, buying steel from China is like buying groceries from the grocery store, he turns around and takes the money and it comes back to me, that's a dumb idea, then politicians will follow. Most politicians understand things pretty well, but they can't get too far ahead of their voters. I think the big challenge for us as economists is the larger circle of ideas that circle the president and Congress and all the gnomes in the bottoms of the administrative agencies who are the ones who actually run this country, in case you haven't noticed. In particular, let's take trade. The insight that free trade is good is an Adam Smith insight. 1770s, along about the same time that, Newton figured out gravity. It's not rocket science. You don't need a chaired professor from Harvard to explain to you why free trade is. You need someone who's a good communicator and can help get the simple key idea across that's needed for right now. Our economic policy is so chaotic. It's so beyond the pale that you need good communicators and thinkers. You need wisdom, not smarts. You need basic understanding, not up-to-the-minute research to kind of provide good advice.
Do you have any interest, like your colleague John Taylor, to go into government for a couple of years?
If the phone starts ringing, we'll talk about that question.
Very good. John Cochran, I enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. It's always a pleasure.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. If you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of John Cochran and his colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. John Cochran has a Twitter feed, which is @JohnHCochran. You spell Cochran, C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E. John H. Cochran, Twitter. And his Grumpy Economist blog is @JohnHCochran.blogspot.com. Did I get that right, John?
Yes, you did.
Good, nailed it. And by all means, tune into your financial channels this week and see if you can catch a glimpse of the Hoover Monetary Conference. As we mentioned, it'll be on the website as well. Anything else we need to plug while I got you here, John?
That's it.
Very good. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org. For Hoover's channels on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.